Here it is.
From deep inside your radio.
Well, this is going to be the last one of these. Don't get excited. From the Le Show Dome for a while. Because fixing to go on the road, ladies and gentlemen, to, first of all, Vancouver. Because that's warm-up country, you know? It's where people go to warm up. And the giant Unweek tour starts Thursday night in Vancouver, gets to Portland and Seattle, and thence Oakland, actually, Los Angeles, you know, unweek.com. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen.
He's not a general. He commands no troops. He's not an inspector. He peeks at no stoops. He's an inspector general.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
A U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission project. Now, you'd think they'd be kind of busy at this point, the Securities and Exchange Commission, what with, you know, the thing that they weren't really paying attention to. But, no, they have a project to rearrange desks at their Washington office. Literally. Not a joke. And it's going to cost $3.9 million. The project has been deemed unnecessary by a majority of the employees of the Securities and Exchange Commission, according to the SEC's Inspector General. It's engaging in the SEC is in a so-called restacking of offices to make sure employees who work in the same division all sit with each other at headquarters. 57% of workers surveyed said they were very satisfied with their existing location. It's a silo configuration. A cost-benefit analysis required before such work was approved wasn't recorded, and the agency didn't analyze whether the desk configuration impeded communication, according to the Inspector General. The restacking project will move about 1,750 employees and require 40,000 square feet of construction. Your Inspector General at work, ladies and gentlemen. And since this is going to be a potentially fairly newsworthy broadcast, another special feature here at the outset. News. Actually, tales. Pardon me. I'm packing. I'm packing for the trip. Tales of airport security. Zach writes, "Dear Harry, love your show." Well, that always gets your tail red. Excuse me? A few weeks ago, I flew back to Idaho from a trip to Southern California and Arizona, Zach writes. Because liquor is so expensive in Idaho. Oh, that's another story. We stocked up on some staples for the liquor cabinet. Or some liquor for the staples. No, sorry. While in Arizona, I purchased a bottle of Everclear, 190 proof grain alcohol for use in making some homemade limoncello. Everclear is not sold in Idaho, nor in any of the states located near where I live. Zach continues. I put the Everclear and some other bottles of liquor in my checked luggage without a second thought. This morning, while preparing for a flight, I looked at the TSA website to see if razors used for shaving are permitted for carry-on, and I noticed there that any liquor over 150 proof is considered an explosive and is prohibited from being brought aboard. Oops. But everything on the flight to Idaho arrived with me safe and sound, including the Everclear. There was even one of those pamphlets that the TSA leaves in your suitcase to indicate that it had been searched. Tales of Airport Security. Ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of Hello, Welcome to the Show.
Keep it coming. Keep it coming on strong. You're busy being who you are. You are right smack dab where you belong. Just keep it feeling right. You can never, ever do no wrong. Keep it coming.
Keep it coming.
Keep it coming my way.
Keep it coming.
I never get enough of you, and you are never getting in my way.
Keep it coming.
You always make right here just right, so that's where I want you to stay. Keep it coming.
Keep it coming.
I'm always ready for more.
Keep it coming.
I'm feeling much more like I do right now than I ever did before.
Keep it coming.
Just give me one more once. You know there ain't nobody keeping score.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer welcoming you to this edition of the show. As I say, won't be saying those words for a while about the geographic origination point of this broadcast. Going on the road, going to be plugging in all over the country. That's so much fun. It's always fun to do that. Anyway, now, ladies and gentlemen, speaking of fun, news from outside the bubble. And it's bubblicious today. A couple stories on our newly expanded enterprise in Afghanistan from the Times of London, owned by Rupert Murdoch. A teacher at a girls' school run by the British charity Care International was killed along with her three children and her brother-in-law during a U.S. Special Forces raid on a nearby house in the eastern Afghan province of Khost. The U.S. military has conceded that the forces killed the civilians in error during the nighttime raid that targeted the neighboring compound of a suspected militant. The father of the dead family is a lieutenant colonel in the Afghan army. According to the police chief for the province, U.S. soldiers climbed onto the wall of the family's compound in the early hours, seeking better vantage points for the raid on the compound of the suspected insurgent. The occupants mistook the U.S. soldiers for thieves breaking into their home and opened fire on them. Most Afghan families store weapons in their homes, just like us. The Americans shot them thinking they were insurgents, the police chief said. A relative of the dead family told reporters that the dead infant was a boy born last week. This was a terrible tragedy, said a U.S. spokesman, Colonel Greg Julian. The dead woman had been trained as a secondary school teacher under a plan developed by CARE International to put small secondary schools for girls inside the homes of respected local families. Her daughter, who was also killed, was a pupil in her class. International aid agencies have repeatedly criticized the night raids carried out by U.S. Special Forces, as has the Afghan government, which is eroding support in Afghanistan for foreign forces. And as you may know, if you've read your history, the Afghans never really have been that fond of foreign forces. But wait, there's more. From the News of Pakistan, a newspaper from Pakistan called The News, of the 60 cross-border Predator strikes carried out by the Afghanistan-based American drones in Pakistan between January and April of this year, only 10 of the 60 were able to hit their actual targets, killing 14 wanted Al-Qaeda leaders and 687 innocent Pakistani civilians. The success rate of the Predator drones thus comes to not more, according to the Pakistani newspaper, than 6%. That's got to make us popular. The remaining 50 drone attacks went wrong due to faulty intelligence information, killing hundreds of innocent civilians, including women and children. Of the 14 strikes carried out in the first days of April of this year, only one proved successful, according to this Pakistani newspaper. But there's more cheerful news from outside the bubble as well, ladies and gentlemen, in a way, in a sense that it helps to spotlight the differences between the French and the United States. Now, you may have, I'm pausing here in the sharing of the news from outside the bubble for just a moment to point out that you may have heard in the welter of news about the piracy incident in the Gulf of Aden involving an American merchant ship whose captain is still being held hostage. You may have heard that the French had a piracy incident this week in which they attacked the pirates. Now, one hostage did die, but they killed a pirate and captured the others. The French, ladies and gentlemen. And this, from the Rupert Murdoch-owned Sunday Times of London. Several French business executives have been locked in their offices by workers in protest against layoffs. This is how the French deal with the economic crisis. France is in a rebellious mood and an outbreak of boss napping. Boss napping is just one symptom. Angry manifestos and anti-establishment screeds are proliferating in bookshops. They still have bookshops in France. Call Glenn Beck and tell him. One such book advocates the sabotage of internet and electricity networks. It has sold 15,000 copies. Police have been trying to determine if cuts in the gas supply to parts of Paris, Toulouse, and Montpellier were the work of union militants hoping to put pressure on bosses over pay. There have already been attempts to sabotage trains. The finance director for a British adhesive factory in France spoke of disappointment at seeing the tactic of boss napping being used by militant workers against three British executives held in the firm's plant for 18 hours on Wednesday. The head of Gucci, François-Henri Pinault, was held captive for an hour by workers protesting job cuts. Several other bosses, including the French director of Sony and Nicolas Polotnik, head of the Caterpillar bulldozer plant in Grenoble, have been held in their offices. Sometimes the kidnapping has seemed like punishment. Workers at the U.S.-owned Fulman Battery Factory in Burgundy forced Alain Royer, their boss, to accompany them on a march wearing a T-shirt emblazoned with the number of people he had fired. It was humiliating, he said. So that is the way the French are dealing with the economic crisis. And that is news from outside the bubble, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Here's how we're dealing with the economic crisis. Fox Television has fast-tracked a new reality, quote-unquote, show called Someone's Gotta Go, in which employees of small offices are told to choose a colleague to fire. This despite some protests that have erupted since the news of this pilot has been leaked. A lot of pilot leaking going on. Production is said to be underway on the program, devised by Endemol. Yes, Endemol, known for Big Brother and Deal or No Deal. Fox has always pushed the envelope. Or actually destroy the envelope. Fox has always pushed the envelope, says Brad Edgate, senior vice president for research at Horizon Media. Mike Darnell, the head of alternative programming for Fox, granted interviews about the premise of Someone's Gotta Go early this week, but he declined to comment on the negative reactions that have spread over the Internet on Friday. Darnell described its premise in his earlier interviews as a combination of Survivor and The Office. As he told the Washington Post, I'm sure you've been through a situation where someone at your company gets fired and you think, why did that guy get fired and that idiot is still here? Not referring to himself, apparently. In Someone's Gotta Go, the firing decisions will be made by the employees who will have access to each person's job reviews and salary figures. The laid-off workers, according to Variety, may receive a small severance. The detail left out of the New York Times coverage of the pilot is fairly crucial. In the Washington Post account, Darnell was asked whether the workers could, in fact, decide to fire the boss. And he was adamant, the boss stays. As I say, just a little idea of how differently the French do it. They go after the pirates, and they go after the bosses. News from outside the bubble. Still copyright after all these years. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm, won't you?
Soft, listen to the warm.
Did you know the worm had such vibrato?
We can listen to the worm.
Yeah. That's one danger sign right there, the vibrato. The North Atlantic Ocean is one of Earth's tools to offset natural carbon dioxide emissions. In fact, the carbon sink in the North Atlantic is the primary gate for carbon dioxide to enter the global ocean and be stored there for about 1,500 years. The oceans have removed nearly 30% of man-made emissions over the last 250 years. But several recent studies show a dramatic decline in the North Atlantic's ability to absorb carbon, to be a carbon sink. Concerned by this decline, a group of international scientists, including Helmuth Thomas, professor of oceanography at Dalhousie University, spent the last 2 years investigating the world's largest carbon sink. They weren't sure what was causing the decrease, whether man-made or natural causes. There were massive changes in the coastal carbon cycle, and it was similar throughout the ocean, says Dr. Thomas, who wrote about the study in Global Biogeochemical Cycles. Recent observational studies found that the North American carbon uptake has decreased by 50% over the last 10 years. Uh-oh. While many are quick to blame anthropogenic man-made climate change, Dr. Thomas and his colleagues found different results. They believe the decrease is a natural phenomenon as a result of the North Atlantic Oscillation, which causes weather patterns to change. The next phase, he says, should once again increase carbon uptake. These natural phenomena have the potential to mask the effects of anthropogenic climate change, so they say. From Science Daily, the latest data from NASA and the University of Colorado at Boulder's National Snow and Ice Data Center show the continuation of a decade-long trend of shrinking sea ice in the Arctic, including new evidence that the ice is thinning as well. Do they make Rogaine for ice? The researchers who've been tracking Arctic sea ice cover with satellites since 1979 found that the winter of 2008-2009 was the fifth lowest maximum ice extent on record. The sixth lowest have all occurred in the past 6 years. The new measurements by the center at CU Boulder show that maximum sea ice extent for 2008 reached 5.85 million square miles. That's 278,000 square miles below the average extent for 1979 to 2000. In addition, the team of CU Boulder researchers has found that younger, thinner ice has replaced older, thicker ice as the dominant type over the past 5 years, making it more prone to summer ice melt. Ice extent is an important measure of the health of the Arctic, but it gives us only a two-dimensional view of the ice cover, said one of the researchers. Thickness is important, especially in the winter, because it is the best overall indicator of the health of the ice. As the ice cover grows thinner, it becomes more vulnerable to summer melt. Scientists believe Arctic sea ice functions like an air conditioner for the global climate system by naturally cooling air and water masses, playing a key role in ocean circulation and reflecting solar radiation back into space, where it belongs. Meanwhile, researchers at the University of Leicester and Oxford have made a discovery about plant growth, which could potentially have an enormous impact on crop production in the era of a warmer or a climatically changed Earth. Dr. Kerry Franklin from the University of Leicester Department of Biology led the study. It's identified a single gene responsible for controlling plant growth that responds to elevated temperature. Dr. Franklin says exposure of plants to high temperature results in the rapid elongation of stems, you're listening, guys, and a dramatic upwards elevation of leaves. These responses are accompanied by a significant reduction in plant biomass, thereby severely reducing the actual harvest yield. Our study reveals that a single gene regulates, or a single gene product regulates, all these architectural adaptations in the plant. He added, this study provides the first major advance in understanding how plants regulate growth responses to elevated temperature. This discovery will prove fundamental in understanding the effects of global climate change on crop productivity. And, of course, will open the door to probably genetic modification to keep those stems down. And finally, Deadline Fresno, California, new report says rising temperatures could make pears, peaches, pistachios, and other crops that begin with P that need winter chill unsuitable for California farms, and others will suffer lower yields. The current issue of California Agriculture, mailed to subscribers this week, is devoted to peer-reviewed articles by researchers at UC, University of California, who paint a dire picture of climate on food production and the environment. They say California temperatures are predicted to increase by 7 degrees Fahrenheit by 2095. I'm out of here. As global temperatures rise, winter rain in the mountains instead of snow could mean overburdened reservoirs that could force water managers to release runoff into rivers long before farmers need it. Means maybe we'll even stop growing the two thirstiest crops on the planet, cotton and rice, in a central valley that's near desert except for the imported water. Or it may not. You never know. News of the Warm, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. I think we're all aware that there's still a lot of to-ing and fro-ing about the financial meltdown. The administration says they see glimmers of hope. There are varying reports about what's happening with the stress test being conducted on banks. Apparently, the administration is telling the banks to dummy up if they know how they did on the reports, because, of course, every bank that said they did well casts and at least an implied stigma at a bank that doesn't say that. And the administration itself is withholding the results of the stress tests until hell freezes. I'm sorry, until later. And although some recipients of bonuses paid by putatively insolvent firms that have received government bailouts, some recipients have paid the bonuses back. Many others are not, and some financial institutions are actually threatening to pay back the government bailout money so that they don't have to cut executive pay or pay back the bonuses. It's almost as if these bonuses are, like, really important.
My baby was a wicked trader, brains of a gamer, balls of a blader. Forbes called him a financial Darth Vader. Don't mean maybe that was my baby. Credit default swaps, CDOs. What the hell they were, my baby knows. Sure they collapse, but his worth grows. Avoiding the onus, just banking his bonus. He's my bonus baby.
Sunday morning, creeping light.
A familiar name and a familiar voice to listeners of this broadcast and to viewers of MyDamnChannel.com, where he recently took us on a tour of the Chifuncta River to show us the possibilities and the dangers of the wetland situation around New Orleans. And Dr. Ivor van Heerden is back in the news, not for the best of reasons. He is now formerly deputy director of the LSU Hurricane Center, and he's consented to talk with us for a few minutes today. Dr. van Heerden, hi.
Well, hi, Harry. Thanks for giving me a call.
When we first talked on this broadcast a couple of years ago in New Orleans, you already had received very clear indications that the people at LSU, which were housing your Hurricane Center and where you were a research professor, were not happy with your publishing some of your findings and discussing them with the media. Now, this seems to have come to a head.
Yeah, just in November 2005, just after I had testified before a Senate panel, I got hauled into a meeting with two vice chancellors at LSU who told me that my speaking to the media was hurting the university's chances of getting federal dollars, and they would prefer that I stopped, and then reminded me that, that I didn't have tenure, and therefore they controlled my money purse. Unfortunately, it didn't stop there. This has gone on and on and on for years, and I think in desperation and possibly because of an upcoming federal trial related to the Corps of Engineers' culpability for the levees failures, they decided to push me out completely.
Now, just for listeners who've come to this fresh, you were one of the heads of a group called Team Louisiana, which did an independent study of the reasons for the flooding of New Orleans, the event that's widely known as Katrina in 2005. And then the basic finding of that study was what?
The Team Louisiana was the official State of Louisiana forensic investigation. It was funded by the state as a contract through LSU. So while we were doing this research, we were LSU employees funded by the state. And what we found was that the levee failures reflected poor designs, a misinterpretation of the science, a really shoddy engineering in terms of looking at the geology of the soils, the geotechnical aspects. And then a huge contributor was the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet Navigation Channel, that the Corps themselves knew about and had ignored for years.
And your team was not the only one to have reached somewhat similar conclusions, was it? I mean, you weren't out there in the wilderness all by yourself.
No, obviously because we were on the ground, we also because of our computer models and direct access to the sites, we realized the day after the storm that these levees couldn't have failed because it was an act of God, as was being claimed by the federal government at the time. So we hit the ground first. Subsequently, there was a team funded by the National Science Foundation, headed by Ray Seed and Bob B. from University of California in Berkeley. Then there's been the IPET team, and then there's been an ongoing review of what the IPET did and the other teams have done. And everybody has come to exactly the same conclusions. You know, we pride ourselves not only because we were a team of academics, we also included three retired geotechnical engineers who had 150 years experience between them. But we prided ourselves in putting out data that we knew was justifiable, and it's we've been totally vindicated by everybody.
So what did LSU tell you, I guess, Thursday when they told you that you were no longer deputy director of the Hurricane Center?
Well, I learned about the not being deputy director through the news media. They basically didn't have the guts to tell me that to my face. what they told me was that I was being terminated, that basically I had a 1 year's notice. They told me that it had nothing to do with my performance, that my performance was not an issue at all, but they couldn't tell me why, and they wouldn't tell me why, and just told me they had the right to fire me, and that I was actually lucky that they were giving me this 1 year's notice.
Were they asking you to thank them at that point?
I don't know. I really don't think. I think there's a couple of things going on here. I honestly don't believe that the Chancellor of LSU knew any of this was happening. I think this is the three characters who are behind this, because are folk who have some ulterior motives, obviously, and the poor fellow who had to give me my notice, I don't believe had anything to do with it. He was just the guy who was pushed into that position.
Have you been planning to testify in the lawsuit that's coming to trial April 20th against the Corps of Engineers?
Yes, I had. When this first got going, in the spring of 2007, the attorneys approached me who were filing the suit if I'd be an expert witness. And it had been my understanding right from the beginning that part of the reason for doing Team Louisiana was in case any suits got filed. So I naturally agreed, but to be an expert witness, you have to get permission from the university. And when I tried to get permission, they dragged their feet. So one of the plaintiff attorneys went and met with then Chancellor Sean O'Keefe, good friends with the Bushes, former NASA administrator, who happened to be chancellor, and he told them straight up that if I testified, I would be fired, and he didn't care if I sued them or what the governor said or anything. And he also told them that nobody from LSU was going to embarrass the Bush administration or upset the major Republican companies that benefit from the Corps of Engineers contract. So what I had to do was to withdraw as a expert witness. However, there's the potential that I will be called forward in the trial as a fact witness, which is a little different. And so, I might end up testifying, but certainly not as an expert, because that right was denied me by LSU.
But as a fact witness, you could be subpoenaed.
Yes, I actually got subpoenaed in a trial, another trial, and at the time I had to notify the university that I was being subpoenaed and that I would be testifying against the Corps of Engineers, and I did that to try at that stage protect my job.
Sean O'Keefe is no longer chancellor of LSU, is that right?
No, he's long gone, but unfortunately the three characters, one's in the provost's office, two are related to the Office of Research, are Sean O'Keefe appointees. They were people brought into their positions by Sean O'Keefe. I believe they all three have strong ties to the Corps of Engineers. And in my opinion, they the ones who are behind this. What's very interesting is even before I'd been laid off, a sign appeared in another building across campus announcing that that was the new location, in essence, of the LSU Hurricane Center. So this is a pretty well-planned affair.
So they were moving the center out from under you?
Well, what they did is they pushed Mark Levitan, who, along with myself, co-founded the Hurricane Center and was the director. They pushed him out about a month ago. And I think that when they did that, that's when I suspected that it wouldn't be long and something like this would happen.
Now, as I understand it from the paper, he has resigned in protest of what they've done to you?
Well, they pushed him out, but so he had actually resigned beforehand. But his resignation was in protest to a large extent of in about 2007. Mark took it upon himself to go and speak to one of the vice chancellors, one of those who had first harassed me in 2005, and speak to him and sort of point out, you know, that what I'm doing is was funded by the state, it's been demanded, I'm just doing my duty as a state employee. And what they told him was, basically, if you fire Ivor, you're the golden boy, the Hurricane Center will flourish. If you don't fire him, you're going to go down the tubes. And then he obviously didn't fire me. He walked out of the meeting. And quite honestly, ever since then, the Hurricane Center has suffered from a total lack of any support from upper administration. And I think part of his resignation was expressing his disgust at the university, especially right now there isn't a Hurricane Center at LSU, no matter what they say. It's a rudderless ship with a sign on a door. No people, no resources.
I haven't talked to you in a while, and in the recent, and it seems to me you've been kind of out of the public eye a bit. But in the past month or so, the Corps of Engineers was in the New Orleans newspaper saying that they were choosing, and this was a nicely delicately phrased way of putting it, the technically not superior option for one of the pieces of the repaired, supposedly repaired levee and flood wall system, and that they were choosing the technically not superior option because, according to them, they didn't have the money to choose the technically superior option. This rang kind of an alarm bell with me, the blandness of the phrase technically not superior. What did it say to you?
Well, I think that particular event, also the fact that they released a plan after spending millions of dollars that was a plan in name only, and also they are now saying they're not in the levee, they're not in the hurricane protection business, they're in the storm reduction process, they're in the risk reduction is what they see that they're doing. And that's telling me that we're not going to get anything like what we believe we deserve in terms of protection, and we're not going to see any serious coastal restoration, at least not until we get the Corps of Engineers out of the way.
Who is suing the Corps of Engineers in this suit that's coming to trial April 20th? And this is in federal court, by the way, right?
Yeah, it's in federal court, in Judge Duval's court. There are two basic suits. One of them, the first one, are six plaintiffs from Orleans East and St. Bernard who filed a suit for damages, obviously. And it's a number of lawyers from Louisiana, New Orleans, New York, California, other areas who've got together and who quite honestly spent a fair amount of money. They brought the Dutch in, so they actually have some of the best modeling brains that you could ever find doing their models. And so that suit goes to trial on the 20th of April for about 3 weeks. And then a little while after that, the class action suit goes to trial. And the class action suit is the biggest that's ever been filed. It's against the federal government at $600 billion. The state of Louisiana, as I understand it, is in there for $200 billion. And I believe that the plaintiffs are going to win. I think they've got far superior science. And also, I think they're going to be able to show very conclusively that the Mississippi River Gulf outlet, which is what the suit's about, contributed very, very significantly to all the flooding in New Orleans.
What are your plans personally, aside from testifying in that trial? You have a year. Are you going to stay at LSU?
Yeah, I'll stay at LSU. Quite honestly, I think these three middle managers have jumped the gun because as we review my paperwork, we realize that, in fact, I should have been given tenure about 3 years ago, so that I'd met all the requirements for somebody in my position. So my first approach is to see if they rethink what they've done. But, you know, I'm not that worried about the future. I definitely want to write some more books. So I'll write out the year and then see what comes up.
Speaking of books, people who heard our original discussion on this program might have taken the recommendation. I'll renew it. Your book, The Storm, is probably the definitive piece of scientific reportage on what exactly happened to New Orleans in 2005. You do not want to name the three individuals, I gather, from the delicate way you've described them in this discussion. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'd prefer right now. They know who they are. they know that we know exactly what's going on. Universities are not places that keep secrets. It's amazing how far emails can travel. But I think it's going to be up to the chancellor. It's going to be up to the LSU Board of Supervisors. The big tragedy here, you know, what happens to me is very small. The real tragedy is that LSU has sent a very, very strong signal to future students, to future faculty, to alumni and others who may want to donate money to the university and to the legislature and to the federal government, that academic freedom at LSU is dead. It doesn't exist. And I think that's the absolute sad truth of what has occurred.
Okay, we'll reserve a moment of silence for academic freedom at LSU. But I'm hoping that we'll be able to hear from you on a fairly consistent basis. Because as I say, when I see that the Corps is proceeding apace with not technically superior solutions, it seems to me we need to hear from people like you and Dr. C, Dr. B, to remind us that we've been down this road before, perhaps.
We went down the road before Betsy. We flooded after Betsy. A number of people lost their lives. Katrina was the big wake-up call. Hurricane Gustav, we nearly lost a levee section on the Industrial Canal that would never made the media. Hurricane Gustav was very, very, very close to another major flooding. Fortunately, the predictions are right now for an average season, but that actually means nothing. You know, hurricanes come and hurricanes go, and they have a mind of their own. We just hope that they're not looking at Louisiana this season.
All right. Ivo van Heerden, thanks for sharing some of your weekend to bring us up to date on what happened with you and LSU. Good luck to you.
Oh, thank you very much, Harry. I do appreciate it.
And the walls come tumbling down, down, down. And the walls come tumbling down, down, down.
My name it is Bo Pipkin, to Canaan land abound. Just traveling through this wilderness on this enchanted ground. You may talk about the king of Gideon, you may talk about the man of Saul. They'll not like good old Joshua at the Battle of Jericho that morning.
Joshua at the Battle of Jericho, Jericho, Jericho. Joshua at the Battle of Jericho, and the walls come tumbling down, down, down. Joshua at the Battle of Jericho, Jericho, Jericho. Joshua at the Battle of Jericho, and the walls come tumbling down, down, down.
Up to the walls of Jericho, hear my trick spear in hand. Go blow them around, more Joshua cried, kiss the battle is in my hand. Up to the walls of Jericho, hear march with spear in hand. Go blow them ram home, the Joshua cried, cause the battle is
walls come tumbling down that morning.
Touch with the battle of Jericho, Jericho, Jericho. Touch with the battle of Jericho, and the walls come tumbling down, 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 down. Touch with the battle of Joshua, touch with the battle of Joshua.
Yeah, yeah.
Joshua, touch with the battle of Joshua.
Or maybe the walls were just built by the United States Army Corps of Engineers. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Dateline Provo, Utah was a bad day for Brigham Young University student-run newspaper. Monday's edition of the Daily Universe ran a photo of several leaders of the Mormon Church at the weekend's general conference. A caption below the photo read in part, "The Quorum of the 12 Apostates." Instead of apostles, the paper apologized for the mistake and gathered up as many of the 18,000 copies that it could. It attributes the mistake to a spell check error made by a copy editor who was under deadline pressure. Because that never happens at newspapers normally. Number 10 Downing Street in London has apologized for emails sent by one of Prime Minister Gordon Brown's senior officials, which reportedly discussed smearing top members of the Conservative Party. The Daily Telegraph says the emails found their way to the writer of a blog who described them as obscene. The emails included unfounded allegations about the Conservative leader David Cameron, as well as other shadow members of the cabinet. Conservatives are now demanding an apology from Prime Minister Gordon Brown himself. The Pentagon here in this country has apologized to CBS for the lengthy delay in turning over network footage. Pool footage of President Obama's visit to Iraq this week. Television executives waited for much of the day on Tuesday for CBS, the Pool Network, to provide the tape. The handoff was bungled when soldiers could not find the CBS representative outside Camp Victory, and the video was not transmitted in time for the evening news. This was an important mission, and that apparently didn't translate to those given the task of providing them to you, says a spokesman for General Ray Odierno, the U.S. commander in Iraq. The right thing to do would have been to wait at the gate until you showed. That didn't happen. Please accept my humble apologies for this unfortunate mishap. But Pentagon spokesman Brian Whitman said CBS made this a lot harder than it had to be by declining an offer for the military to transmit the tape by satellite from Saddam Hussein's former palace, requiring a hand delivery. A CBS executive said the network considered that method unreliable. Cop apologies. Philadelphia Police Commissioner Charles Ramsey says he's issued an apology to a state representative in connection with allegations that the legislator was roughed up by police. Ramsey says the department's internal affairs division was investigating. It wasn't supposed to happen that way, Ramsey said of a March 28th incident in which the state representative Jewel Williams, a former police officer at Temple University, said he was handcuffed and thrown into the back of a police car after asking questions at a police car stop involving two other men. And Dateline Vancouver, where I'll be Thursday with the Unwig Tour. Ooh, be nice to me, Vancouver police, will you? But Vancouver Police Chief Jim Chu apologized this week for the seizure of a Vancouver province photographer's camera as he took pictures at the scene of a police shooting last week. I want to apologize for this unfortunate incident and assure you we are taking steps to ensure that such an incident doesn't happen again, Chu says. This is after a police officer confiscated the camera of Jason Payne, who was taking pictures at the scene of a police shooting of a man driving a stolen pickup truck at about 5:20 p.m. Sunday. As police officers, we know or should know that media personnel have special protections in law. Also, guys on an acoustic music tour. Heidi Montag, You Tell Me, has apologized to fans for the release of a curse-filled track, More Is More, on the Internet. The reality TV star turned singer insists the inappropriate tune was never meant to be released, much like her career. A Texas lawmaker under fire for saying that Asian American voters should adopt names that are easier for Americans has apologized for her remarks. State Representative Betty Brown issued an apology for the comments made during a committee hearing. Dateline Seoul, South Korea, former South Korean President No Moo-hyun says he accepted money from an indicted businessman and will cooperate with a bribery investigation. In a web post entitled, I Apologize, he said his wife received money from a scandal-plagued shoe manufacturer. Those scandal-plagued shoe manufacturers, ladies and gentlemen. They'll get you in trouble every time. And Carrie Underwood, another TV star, has apologized to Matthew McConaughey after making a sexual joke about the actor during her acceptance speech at the Academy of Country Music Awards. Matthew McConaughey introduced her, giving the prize, saying his brother used to pick up women by telling them they made boots for country star George Strait. When Underwood joined McConaughey on the podium, she quipped, "I want to see those boots, Matthew." The singer now says she regrets her choice of words and says she didn't mean to be rude. "I'm so embarrassed. I'm totally embarrassed myself. I just blanked. You want to say something eloquent in a moment like that?" Speaking of which, after getting trashed in the press for coming off like a complete jerk during an interview on Canadian radio, Billy Bob Thornton has finally shown his nicer side. He has apologized and said, "I love Canada, absolutely. Hey, I'm going to Vancouver this week." So do I. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. That's going to put the finger in the dike of this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America by the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, on Mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world by the internet at two different locations, live and archive whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, available as a free download for members at www.audible.com/the show, available as a free podcast at kcrw.com, and check out stitcher.com, an iPhone app where you can now also receive the show, stitcher.com. And it'd be just like being treated nicely by the police in Vancouver if you agree to join with me then, would you? All right, thank you very much. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. Talk to you from the Pacific Northwest next week.